place. The march toward horror was speeding up. Already, the shore's shadow darkened the innocent people herded into the Vélodrome d'Hiver. This year, like every year, we are gathered together in this place to remember, so as to forget nothing of the persecutions, the hunting down, and shatter the destiny of so many French Jews.
An old man on my left took a handkerchief from his pocket and wept noiselessly. My heart went out to him. Who was he crying for? I wondered. Who had he lost? As the Prime Minister went on, my eyes moved over the crowd. Was there anyone here who knew and remembered Sarah Starzynski? Was she here herself, right now, at this very moment? Was she here with a husband, a child, a grandchild, behind me, in front of me? I carefully picked out women in their 70s, scanning wrinkled, solemn faces for the slanted green eyes. But I did not feel comfortable ogling these grieving strangers. I lowered my gaze. The Prime Minister's voice seemed to gain in strength and clarity, booming out over us.
Yes, Veldiv, Drancy, and all the transit camps, those antechambers of death, were organized, run, and guarded by Frenchmen. Yes, the first act of the shore took place right here, with the complicity of the French state.
The many faces around me appeared to be serene, listening to the Prime Minister. I watched them as he continued with the same powerful voice. But every one of those faces contained sorrow, sorrow that could never be erased. The Prime Minister's speech was applauded for a long time. I noticed people crying, hugging each other. Still with Guillaume, I went to speak to Franck Lévy, who was carrying a copy of Seine Scenes under his arm. He greeted me warmly, introduced us to a couple of journalists. A few moments later, we left. I told Guillaume I had found out who lived in the Tézac apartment, that somehow this had brought me closer to my father-in-law, who had kept a dark secret for over 60 years, and that I was trying to trace Sarah, the little girl who had escaped from Bonne-la-Hollande. In half an hour, I was meeting Nathalie Dufort in front of the Pasteur metro station. She was going to drive me to Orléans, to her grandfather. Guillaume kissed me warmly and hugged me. He said he wished me luck. As I crossed the busy avenue, my palm caressed my stomach. If I had not left the clinic this morning, I would have been regaining consciousness by now in my cozy apricot room, watched over by the beaming nurse. A dainty breakfast, croissant, jam, and café au lait, and I would have left the place alone in the afternoon, a little unsteadily, a sanitary pad between my legs, a dull pain in my lower abdomen, a void in my mind and in my heart. I had not heard a word from Bertrand. Had the clinic telephoned him to inform him I'd left before the abortion? I did not know. He was still in Brussels, due back tonight. I wondered how I'd tell him, how he would take it. As I walked down the Avenue Émile Zola, anxious not to be late for Nathalie Dufort, I wondered if I still cared about what Bertrand thought, about what Bertrand felt. The unsettling thought frightened me. When I got back from Orléans in the early evening, the apartment felt hot and stuffy. I went to open a window, leaned out to the noisy Boulevard de Montparnasse. It was strange to imagine that we'd soon be leaving for the quiet Rue de Saint-Ange. We had spent 12 years here. Zoe had never lived anywhere else. It would be our last summer here, I thought fleetingly. I had grown fond of this apartment, the sunlight coming in every afternoon into the large white living room, the Luxembourg garden just down the Rue Vavin, the easiness of being situated in one of Paris's most active arrondissements, one of the places you could actually feel the city's heartbeat, its rapid, exciting pulse. I kicked off my sandals and lay down on the soft, beige sofa. The fullness of the day weighed upon me like lead. I shut my eyes and was immediately startled back to reality by the phone. It was my sister calling from her office overlooking Central Park. I imagined her behind her vast desk, her reading glasses perched on the end of her nose. Briefly, I told her I had not gone through with the abortion.
"Oh my God," breathed Sharla. "You didn't do it."
"I couldn't," I said. "It was impossible." I could hear her smiling down the phone, that wide, irresistible smile.
"You brave, wonderful girl," she said. "I'm proud of you, honey."
"Bertrand still doesn't know," I said. "He won't be back till later on this evening." "He probably thinks I've done it." A transatlantic pause.
"You will tell him, won't you?"
"Of course, I'll have to, at some point." After my conversation with my sister, I lay on the sofa for a long time, my hand folded over my stomach like a protective shield. Little by little, I felt vitality pumping back into me. As ever, I thought of Sarah Starzynski and of what I now knew. I had not needed to tape Gaspard Dufour, nor jot anything down. It was all written inside me. A small, neat house on the outskirts of Orléans. Prim flower beds. An old, placid dog with failing eyesight. A little old lady cutting up vegetables at the sink, and who nodded at me as I came in. Gaspard Dufour's gruff voice, his blue-veined hand patting the dog's wizened head, and what he had said.
"My brother and I knew there had been trouble during the war, but we were small then, and we didn't remember what the trouble was. It was only after my grandparents died that I found out from my father that Sarah Dufour was in fact called Starzynski, and that she was Jewish. My grandparents had hidden her for all those years. There was something sad about Sarah. She was not a joyful, outgoing person. She was hard to get through to. We had been told she had been adopted by my grandparents because her parents had died during the war. That's all we knew. But we could tell she was different. When she came to church with us, her lips never moved during the Our Father. She never prayed. She never received communion. She would stare in front of her with a frozen expression that frightened me. My grandparents would smile at us firmly and tell us to leave her alone. My parents did the same. Little by little, Sarah became part of our lives, the older sister we never had. And she grew into a lovely, melancholy young girl. She was very serious, mature for her years. Sometimes, after the war, we would go to Paris with my parents, but Sarah never wanted to come. She said she hated Paris. She said she never wanted to go back there again."
"Did she ever talk about her brother, her parents?" I asked. Gaspard shook his head.
"Never. I only heard about her brother and what happened from my father 40 years ago. When I was living with her, I never knew."
Nathalie Dufour's voice piped up.
"What happened to her brother?" she asked.
Gaspard Dufour glanced at his fascinated granddaughter, hanging on to every word. Then he looked at his wife, who had not spoken during the entire conversation, but who looked on benignly.
"I will tell you about it another time, Natu. It's a very sad story."
There was a long pause. "Monsieur Dufour," I said, "I need to know where Sarah Starzynski is now. This is why I have come to see you. Can you help me?" Gaspard Dufour scratched his head and shot me a quizzical look.
"What I really need to know, Mademoiselle Germain," he grinned, "is why this is so important to you."
The phone rang again. It was Zoe from Long Island. She was having a great time, the weather was fine, she had a tan, a new bicycle, her cousin Cooper was neat,
but she missed me. I told her I missed her, too, and that I'd be with her in less than 10 days. Then she lowered her voice and asked if I had made any progress in locating Sarah Starzynski. I had to smile at the seriousness of her tone. I said that as a matter of fact I had made progress, and I was going to tell her about it very quickly.
"Oh, Mom, what progress?"
she panted.
"I have to know, now!"
"All right," I said, giving in to her enthusiasm. "Today I met a man who knew her well as a young girl. He told me that Sarah left France in 1952 for New York City to become a nanny for an American family." Zoe whooped.
"You mean she's in the States?"
"I guess so," I said. A little silence.
"How are you going to find her in the States, Mom?"
she asked, her voice clearly less cheerful.
"The States are so much bigger than France."
"God knows, honey," I sighed. I kissed her fervently through the phone, sent all my love, and hung up.
"What I really need to know, Mademoiselle Germain, is why this is so important to you."
I had decided on the spur of the moment to tell Gaspard Dufort the truth, how Sarah Starzynski had come into my life, how I had discovered her terrible secret, and how she was linked to my in-laws, how, now that I knew about the events of the summer of 1942, both the public events, the Veldive, Bonne-la-Hollande, and the private ones, little Michelle Starzynski's death in the Tézac apartment, finding Sarah had become a major goal, something I strove for with all my might. Gaspard Dufort had been surprised at my doggedness.
"Why find her? What for?"
he had asked, shaking his grizzled head. I had replied, "To tell her we care. To tell her we have not forgotten."
"We,"
he had smiled. "Who was the
we?"
"My family-in-law, the French people." And then I had retorted, slightly irritated by his grin, "No, me, just me. I wanted to say sorry. I wanted to tell her I could not forget the roundup, the camp, Michelle's death, and the direct train to Auschwitz that had taken her parents away forever."
"Sorry for what?"
he had retaliated. "Why should I, an American, feel sorry? Hadn't my fellow countrymen freed France in June 1944? I had nothing to be sorry for," he laughed. I had looked at him straight in the eyes. "Sorry for not knowing. Sorry for being 45 years old and not knowing." Sarah had left France in late 1952. She had gone to America. "Why the States?" I asked.
"She told us she had to get away, to a place that had not been touched directly by the Holocaust, in the way France was. We were all upset, especially my grandparents. They loved her like the daughter they never had. But she would not be swayed. She left. And she never came back. At least, not that I know of."
"Then what happened to her?" I asked, sounding like Nathalie, using the same fervor, the same earnestness. Gaspard Dufort shrugged, sighed deeply. He had gotten up, followed by the blind old dog. His wife had made me another cup of powerful, harsh coffee. Their granddaughter had remained silent, curled up in the armchair, her eyes going from him to me in a silent, endearing manner. She would remember this, I thought. She would remember it all. Her grandfather came to sit down again with a grunt, handing me the coffee. He had looked around the small room, the faded photographs on the wall, the tired furniture. He had scratched his head and sighed. I waited, and Nathalie waited. Then he spoke at last. They had never heard from Sarah after 1955.
"She wrote a couple of letters to my grandparents, and a year later she sent a card to say she was getting married. I remember my father telling us Sarah was marrying a Yankee.
Gaspar smiled.
We were delighted for her. But then, there were no more calls. No more letters. Ever again.
My grandparents tried to trace her. They did all they could to find her. Called New York, wrote letters, sent telegrams. They tried to locate her husband. Nothing.
Sarah had disappeared. It was dreadful for them. They waited and waited year after year for a sign, a call, a card. Nothing came. Then my grandfather passed away in the early 60s, followed by my grandmother a few years later. I think their hearts were broken.
You know your grandparents could be declared righteous among the nations, I said.
What does that mean?
He asked, puzzled. The Yad Vashem Institute in Jerusalem gives medals to those non-Jewish who saved Jews during the war. It can also be obtained posthumously. He cleared his throat, looking away from me.
Just find her. Please find her, Mademoiselle Germain. Tell her I miss her. My brother Nicolas, too. Tell her we send all our love.
Before I left, he handed me a letter.
My grandmother wrote this to my father after the war. Maybe you'd like to look at it. You can give it back to Natalie when you've read it.
Later on, at home alone, I deciphered the old-fashioned handwriting. As I read, I cried. I managed to calm down, wiped away my tears, blew my nose. Then I called Edouard and read it out loud to him on the phone. He sounded like he was crying, but he appeared to be doing everything he could to make me think he wasn't. He thanked me with a strangled voice and hung up.
September 8th, 1946. Alain, my dear son. When Sarah came back last week from spending the summer with you and Henriette, she had pink cheeks and a smile. Jules and I were amazed and thrilled. She will be writing to you herself to thank you, but I wanted to tell you how grateful I am for your help and hospitality. These have been 4 grim years, as you know. 4 years of captivity, of fear, of deprivation. For all of us, for our country, 4 years that have taken their toll on Jules and me, but especially on Sarah. I do not think she has ever gotten over what happened in the summer of 1942, when we took her back to her family's apartment in the Marais. That day, something broke within her. Something collapsed. None of this has been easy, and your support has been invaluable. Hiding Sarah from the enemy, keeping her safe from that long-ago summer all the way to the armistice has been horrendous. But Sarah now has a family. We are her family. Your sons, Gaspard and Nicolas, are her brothers. She is a Dufour. She bears our name. I know she will never forget. Behind the rosy cheeks and the smile, there is a hardness about her. She will never be a normal 14-year-old child. She is like a woman, a bitter woman. Sometimes it seems she is older than me. She never talks about her family, about her brother, but I know she carries them with her always. I know she goes to the cemetery every week, sometimes more often, to visit her brother's grave. She wants to go alone. She refuses my company. Sometimes I follow her just to make sure she's all right. She sits in front of the little tombstone, and she remains very still. She can sit there for hours, holding that brass key she carries around with her, always. The key to the cupboard, where her poor little brother died. When she comes back home, her face is shut and cold. It is difficult for her to talk, to make contact with me. I try to give her all the love I have, for she is the daughter I never gave birth to. She never talks about Bonne-la-Rolande. If ever we drive near the village, she goes white. She turns her head away and closes her eyes. I wonder if one day the world will know, if it will all come out into the open, what happened there, or if it will stay a secret forever, buried in a dark, disturbed past. In the past year, since the end of the war, Jules has been to the Lutetia often, sometimes with Sarah, to keep abreast of the people coming home from the camps. Hoping, always hoping. We all hoped, with all our might. But now we know. Her parents will never come back. They were killed at Auschwitz, during that terrible summer of 1942. I sometimes wonder how many children, like her, went through hell and survived, and now have to go on, without their loved ones. So much suffering, so much pain. Sarah has had to give up everything she was. Her family, her name, her religion. We don't ever talk about it, but I know how deep the void is, how cruel her loss is. Sarah talks of leaving the country, of starting anew somewhere else, far away from everything she has known, everything she has gone through. She is too small now, too fragile to leave the farm, but the day will come. Jules and I will have to let her go. Yes, the war is over, at last over, but for your father and me nothing is the same. Nothing will ever be the same. Peace has a bitter taste, and the future is foreboding. The events that have taken place have changed the face of the world, and of France. France is still recovering from her darkest years. Will she ever recover, I wonder? This is no longer the France I knew when I was a little girl. This is another France that I don't recognize. I am old now, and I know my days are numbered. But Sarah, Gaspard, and Nicolas are still young. They will have to live in this new France. I pity them, and I fear what lies ahead. My dear boy, this was not meant to be a sad letter. Alas, it has turned out that way, and I am indeed sorry. The garden needs tending to. The chickens must be fed. And I shall sign off. Let me thank you again for everything you have done for Sarah. God bless you both for your generosity, your faithfulness, and God bless your boys. Your loving mother, Genevieve.
Another phone call. My cellular. I should have turned it off. It was Joshua. I was surprised to hear him. He didn't usually call this late.
"Just saw you on the news, sugar," he drawled. "Looking pretty as a picture, a trifle pale but very glamoroso."
"The news?" I breathed. "What news?"
"Turned on my TV for the 8 o'clock news on TF1, and there's my Julia, just below the Prime Minister."
"Oh," I said, "the Valdiv ceremony."
"Good speech, didn't you think?"
"Very good." A pause. I heard the click of his lighter as he lit up a mild Marlboro, the silver box ones, the kind you only get in the States. I wondered what he had to say to me. He was usually blunt, too blunt. "What is it, Joshua?" I asked warily.
"Nothing, really. Just called to say you did a good job. That Valdiv piece of yours is getting talked about. I just wanted to tell you. Bamba's photos are great, too. You guys pulled it off just fine."
"Oh," I said. "Thank you." But I knew him better than that. "Anything else?" I added carefully.
"There's one thing that bothers me."
"Go ahead," I said.
"One thing missing, in my opinion. You got the survivors. the witnesses, the old guy at Bon La Rolande, etc. All that is fine. Fine, fine. But you forgot a couple of things.
The cops.
The French cops.
Well? I asked, beginning to feel exasperation nibble at me. What about the French cops?
It would have been perfect if you could have gotten those roundup cops to talk. If you could have found a couple of those guys just to hear their side of the story, even if they're old men now. What did these guys tell their kids? Did their families ever know?
He was right, of course. It had never entered my head. The exasperation waned. I said nothing, crushed.
Hey, Julia. No problem, Joshua chuckled. You did a great job. Maybe those cops would never have talked anyway. You probably didn't read much about them in your research, did you?
No, I said. Come to think of it, there is nothing about how the French police felt in what I read. They were only doing their jobs.
Yeah, their jobs, echoed Joshua. But I sure would have liked to have known how they lived with that. And come to think of it, what about those fellas driving those endless trains from Drancy to Auschwitz? Did they know what they were carrying? Did they really think it was cattle? Did they know where they were taking these people, what was going to happen to them? And all the guys driving those buses, did they know anything?
He was right again, of course. I remained silent. A good journalist would have delved deep into those taboos. French police, French railway, French bus system. But I had been obsessed with the Veldiv children, and one child in particular.
You okay, Julia?
Came his voice.
Peachy keen,
I lied.
You need some time off, he declared. Time to climb into a plane and go home.
That's exactly what I had in mind. The last phone call of the evening had been from Nathalie Dufour. She sounded ecstatic. I imagined her waif-like face lit up with excitement, her brown eyes glowing.
Julia, I looked through old Papi's papers and I found it. I found Sarah's card.
Sarah's card? I repeated, lost.
The card she sent to say she was getting married, the last card. She gives the name of her husband.
I grabbed a pen, fumbled around in vain for a piece of paper. No paper. I pointed the ballpoint at the back of my hand. And the name is?
She wrote to say she was marrying Richard J. Rainsford.
She spelt the name out.
The card is dated March 15th, 1955. No address, nothing else, just that.
Richard J. Rainsford, I repeated, writing it in block letters on my skin. I thanked Nathalie, promised to keep her informed of my progress, then dialed Charla's number in Manhattan. I got her assistant, Tina, who put me on hold for a while. Then Charla's voice came through.
You again, honey pie?
I went straight to the point. How do you find someone in the States, get hold of someone?
Phone book,
she said. Is it that easy?
There are other ways, she replied cryptically.
What about a person who disappeared in 1955?
You got a social security number, license plate, or even an address?
Nope, nothing. She whistled through her teeth.
It'll be tough. Might not work. I'll try, though. I have a couple of pals who could help. Give me the name.
At that moment, I heard the front door slam, the jangle of keys being tossed onto the table. My husband, back from Brussels.
I'll get back to you,
I whispered to my sister and hung up. Bertrand walked into the room. He looked tense, pale. His face was drawn. He came to me, took me in his arms. I felt his chin nestle on top of my head. I felt I had to speak fast. I didn't do it, I said. He hardly moved.
I know,
he answered.
The doctor phoned me.
I pulled away from him. I couldn't, Bertrand. He smiled, a strange, desperate smile. He went over to the tray by the window where we kept liquor and poured cognac into a glass. I noticed how fast he drank it, his head snapping back. It was an ugly gesture, and it stirred me.
So what now?
He said, putting the glass down squarely.
What do we do now?
I tried to smile, but I could tell it was a fake, cheerless one. Bertrand sat on the sofa, loosened his tie, opening the first two buttons of his shirt. Then he said,
I can't face the idea of this child, Julia. I tried to tell you. You wouldn't listen.
Something in his voice made me look closer at him. He seemed vulnerable, run down. For a split second, I saw Edouard Tézac's weary face, the expression he had in the car when he told me about Sarah coming back.
I can't stop you having this baby, but I need you to know that I just can't come to terms with it. Having this child is going to destroy me.
I wanted to express pity. He seemed lost, defenseless. But instead, an unexpected feeling of resentment took over me. Destroy you? I repeated. Bertrand got up, poured himself another drink. I glanced away as he swallowed it.
Ever heard of midlife crisis, amour? You Americans are so fond of that expression. You've been wrapped up in your job, your friends, your daughter. You haven't even noticed what I've been going through. To tell the truth, you don't care, do you?
I stared at him, startled. He lay back on the sofa, slowly, carefully, gazing up at the ceiling. Slow, precautious gestures I'd never seen him use. The skin of his face seemed crumpled. All of a sudden, I was looking at an aging husband. Gone was the young Bertrand. Bertrand had always been triumphantly young, vibrant, energetic, the kind of person who never sits still, always on the go, buoyant, fast, eager. The man I was staring at was like a ghost of his former self. When had this happened? How could I not have seen it? Bertrand and his tremendous laugh, his jokes, his audacity. Is that your husband? People would whisper, awed, galvanized. Bertrand at dinner parties, monopolizing conversations, but nobody cared, he was so riveting. Bertrand's way of looking at you, the powerful flicker of his blue eyes and that crooked, devilish smile. Tonight there was nothing tight, nothing taut about him. He seemed to have let go. He sat there, flaccid, limp. His eyes were mournful. His lids drooped.
You never noticed, have you, what I've been going through, have you?
His voice was flat, toneless. I sat down next to him, stroked his hand. How could I ever admit I had not noticed? How could I ever explain how guilty I felt? Why didn't you tell me, Bertrand? The corners of his mouth turned down.
I tried. It never worked.
Why? Then his face went hard. He let out a small, dry laugh.
You don't listen to me, Julia.
And I knew he was right. That awful night when his voice had become hoarse, when he had expressed his greatest fear, growing old, when I realized he was fragile, much more fragile than I had ever imagined, and I had looked away. It had disturbed me. It had repelled me. And he had sensed it, and he had not dared tell me how bad that had made him feel. I said nothing, sitting next to him, holding his hand. The irony of the situation dawned upon me. A depressed husband, a failing marriage, a baby on the way. Why don't we go out for a bite to eat? Down to the Select, or the Rotonde, I said gently. We can talk things over. He heaved himself up.
Another time, maybe. I'm tired.
It occurred to me that he had often been tired in the past months, too tired to go to the movies, too tired to go jogging around the Luxembourg Garden, too tired to take Zoe to Versailles on a Sunday afternoon, too tired to make love. Make love. When was the last time? Weeks ago. I watched him lumber across the room, his gait heavy. He had put on weight. I hadn't noticed that either. Bertrand was so careful about his appearance.
You've been wrapped up in your job, your friends, your daughter you haven't even noticed. You don't listen to me, Julia.
I felt shame race through me. Didn't I need to face up to the truth? Bertrand had not been part of my life in the past weeks, even if we shared the same bed, lived under the same roof. I hadn't told him about Sarah Starzynski, about my new relationship with Edouard. Hadn't I left Bertrand out of everything important to me? I had cut him out of my life. And the irony was that I was carrying his child. From the kitchen, I heard him opening the fridge, caught the rustle of tinfoil. He came back to the living room, a chicken leg in one hand, foil in the other.
Just one thing, Julia.
Yes, I said.
When I told you I couldn't face this child, I meant it. You've made up your mind. Fine. Now this is my decision. I need time to myself. I need time off. You and Zoe will move into the Rue de Saint-Ange after the summer. I'll find another place to live, nearby. Then we'll see how things go. Maybe by then, I can come to terms with this pregnancy. If not, we'll get a divorce.
This was no surprise. I had expected it all along. I got up, smoothed out my dress. I said calmly, "The only thing that matters now is Zoe. Whatever happens, we will have to talk to her, you and I. We will have to prepare her. We have to do this right." He put the chicken leg back into the foil.
"Why are you so tough, Julia?" he said.
There was no sarcasm in his tone, only bitterness.
"You sound just like your sister."
I did not reply, heading out of the room. I went to the bathroom and turned on the water. Then it hit me. Hadn't I made my choice? I had chosen the baby over Bertrand. I had not been softened by his point of view, his inner fears. I had not been scared of his moving out for a couple of months, or indefinitely. Bertrand could not disappear. He was the father of my daughter, of the child within me. He could never completely walk out of our lives. But as I looked at myself in the mirror, steam slowly filling the room, erasing my reflection with its misty breath, I felt everything had changed drastically. Did I still love Bertrand? Did I still need him? How could I want his child and not him? I wanted to cry, but the tears did not come. I was still in the bath when he came in. He was holding the red Sarah file I had left in my bag.
"What is this?"
he said, brandishing the file. Startled, I moved abruptly, making the water slop over one side of the bath. His face was confused, flushed. He promptly sat down on the closed toilet. At any other time, I would have laughed outright at the ludicrousness of his position. "Let me explain," I began. He raised his hand.
"You just can't help it, can you? You just can't leave the past alone."
He glanced through the file, leafed through the letters from Jules Dufort to André Tézac, examined the photographs of Sarah.
"What is all this? Who gave this to you?"
"Your father," I answered quietly. He stared at me.
"What does my father have to do with this?"
I stepped out of the bath, grabbed a towel, turned my back on him as I dried myself. Somehow I did not want his eyes on my naked skin. "It's a long story, Bertrand."
"Why did you have to bring all this back? This stuff happened 60 years ago. It's all dead. It's all forgotten."
I swung around to face him. "No, it isn't. 60 years ago, something happened to your family, something you don't know about. You and your sisters don't know anything. Neither does Mame. His mouth fell open. He seemed astounded.
What happened? You tell me,
he demanded. I snatched the file away from him, holding it against me. You tell me what you were doing going through my bag. We sounded like kids fighting it out at recess. He rolled his eyes.
I saw the file in your bag. I wondered what it was, that's all.
I often have files in my bag. You've never looked at them before.
That is not the issue. You tell me what all this is about. You tell me right now.
I shook my head. Bertrand, call your father. Tell him you found the file. Ask him.
You don't trust me, is that it?
His face sagged. I felt sudden pity for him. He seemed hurt, incredulous. Your father begged me not to tell you, I said gently. Bertrand got up wearily from the toilet seat and reached over to put his hand on the doorknob. He looked beaten, spent. He stepped back to stroke my cheek, softly. His fingers were warm against my face.
Julia, what happened to us? Where did it all go?
Then he left the room. The tears came, and I let them run down my face. He heard me sobbing, but he did not come back. During the summer of 2002, with the knowledge that Sarah Starzynski had left Paris for New York City 50 years ago, I felt propelled back across the Atlantic like a piece of steel pulled by a powerful magnet. I could not wait to leave town. I could not wait to see Zoe and to search for Richard J. Rainsford. I could not wait to board that plane. I wondered if Bertrand called his father to find out what had happened in the Rue de Saint-Ange apartment all those years ago. Bertrand said nothing. He remained cordial, but aloof. I felt he, too, was impatient for me to leave. So that he could think things over? See Amélie? I did not know. I did not care. I told myself I did not care. A couple of hours before my departure to New York, I called my father-in-law to say goodbye. He did not mention having a conversation with Bertrand, and I did not ask him.
Why did Sarah stop writing to the Dufour?
Edouard asked.
What do you think happened, Julia?
I don't know, Edouard, but I'm going to do my best to find out. Those very questions haunted me night and day. When I boarded the plane a few hours later, I was still asking myself the same thing. Was Sarah Starzynski still alive? My sister. Her shiny chestnut hair, her dimples, her beautiful blue eyes, her strong, athletic build, so like our mom's. Les Sœurs Jamon, towering above all the other women on the Tézac side. The puzzled, bright smiles. A twinge of envy. Why are you Américaine so tall? Is it something in your food? Vitamins? Hormones? Charlotte was even taller than me. A couple of pregnancies had done nothing to add padding to her powerful, sleek frame. The minute she saw my face at the airport, Charlotte knew something was on my mind, and that it had nothing to do with the baby I had decided to keep or with marital difficulties. As we drove into the city, her cell phone rang incessantly. Her assistant, her boss, her clients, her kids, the babysitter, Ben, her ex-husband from Long Island, Barry, her present husband, on a business trip to Atlanta. The calls never seemed to stop. I was so happy to see her, I did not care. Just being next to her, our shoulders brushing, made me happy. Once we were alone in her narrow brownstone on East 81st Street, in her spotless, chromed kitchen, and once she had poured out white wine for her and apple juice for me, on account of my pregnancy, out the entire story came. Charla knew little about France. She did not speak much French, Spanish being the only other language she was fluent in. Occupied France meant little to her. She sat in silence as I explained the roundup, the camps, the trains to Poland. Paris in July, 1942. The Rue de Saint-Ange apartment. Sarah. Michelle, her brother. I watched her lovely face grow pale with horror. The glass of white wine remained untouched. She pressed her fingers hard upon her mouth, shook her head. I went right to the end of the story, to Sarah's last card, dated 1955, from New York City. Then she said,
"Oh, my God."
She took a quick sip of the wine.
"You've come here for her, right?"
I nodded.
"How on earth are you going to start?"
"That name I called you about, remember? Richard J. Rainsford. That's her husband's name."
"Rainsford?"
she said. I spelled it. Sharla got up swiftly, took the cordless phone. "What are you doing?" I said. She held up her hand, motioning for me to keep quiet.
"Hi, operator. I'm looking for a Richard J. Rainsford, New York State." "That's right. R-A-I-N-S-F-E-R-D. "Nothing?" "Okay, can you check New Jersey, please?" "Nothing?" "Connecticut?" "Great." "Yes, thank you. Just a minute."
She wrote something down on a scrap of paper. Then she handed it to me with a flourish.
"We got her,"
she said triumphantly. Incredulous, I read the number and the address. Mr. and Mrs. R.J. Rainsford, 2299 Sheffog Drive, Roxbury, Connecticut. "It can't be them," I muttered. "It's just not that easy."
"Roxbury,"
Sharla mused.
"Isn't that in Litchfield County? I used to have a beau there." "You were gone by then. Greg Tanner. A real cutie. His dad was a doctor. Pretty place, Roxbury. About 100 miles from Manhattan."
I sat on my high stool, flabbergasted. I simply could not believe that finding Sarah Starzynski had been so easy, so swift. I had barely landed. I hadn't even talked to my daughter. And I had already located Sarah. She was still alive. It seemed impossible, unreal.
"Listen," I said, "how do we know it's her, for sure?"
Sharla was sitting at the table, busy powering up her laptop. She fished around in her bag for her glasses and slid them over her nose.
"We're going to find out right away."
I came to stand behind her as her fingers ran deftly over the keyboard.
"What are you doing now?"
I asked, mystified.
"Keep your hair on,"
she snapped, typing away. Over her shoulder, I saw she was already on the internet. The screen read, "Welcome to Roxbury, Connecticut. Events, social gatherings, people, real estate."
"Perfect. Just what we need,"
said Sharla, studying the screen. Then she smoothly picked the scrap of paper from my fingers, took the phone again, and dialed the number on the paper. This was going too fast. It was knocking the wind out of me.
"Sharla, wait! What the hell are you going to say, for God's sake?"
She cupped her palm over the receiver. The blue eyes went indignant over the rim of her glasses.
"You trust me, don't you?"
She used the lawyer's voice. Powerful, in control. I could only nod. I felt helpless, panicky. I got up, paced around the kitchen, fingering appliances, smooth surfaces. When I looked back at her, she grinned.
"Maybe you should have some of that wine after all, and don't worry about caller ID. 212 won't show up."
She suddenly held up a forefinger, pointed to the phone.
"Yes, hi, good evening. Is that, Mrs. Rainsford?"
I could not help smiling at the nasal whine. She had always been good at changing her voice.
"Oh, I'm sorry, she's out?"
Mrs. Rainsford was out. So there really was a Mrs. Rainsford. I listened on, incredulous.
"Yes, this is Sharon Burstall from the Minor Memorial Library on South Street. I'm wondering if you'd be interested in coming to our first summer get-together, scheduled on August 2nd. Oh, I see. Gee, I'm sorry, ma'am. Yes, I'm real sorry for the disturbance, ma'am. Thank you, goodbye."
She put the phone down and flashed a self-satisfied smile at me.
"Well?"
I gasped.
"The woman I spoke to is Richard Rainsford's nurse. He's a sick old man, bedridden, needs heavy treatment.
She comes in every afternoon.
And Mrs. Rainsford? I asked impatiently.
Due back any minute.
I looked at Sharla blankly. So what do I do? I said. I just go there? My sister laughed.
You got any other idea?
There it was. Number 2299 Shepog Drive. I turned the motor off and stayed in the car, clammy palms resting on my knees. I could see the house from where I sat, beyond the twin pillars of gray stone at the gate. It was a squat, colonial-style place, probably built in the late 30s, I guessed. Less impressive than the sprawling million-dollar estates I had glimpsed on my way there, but tasteful and harmonious. As I had driven up Route 67, I had been struck by the unspoiled, rural beauty of Litchfield County. Rolling hills, sparkling rivers, lush vegetation, even during the full blast of summer. I had forgotten how hot New England could get. Despite the powerful air conditioner, I sweltered. I wished I had taken a bottle of mineral water with me. My throat felt parched. Sharla had mentioned Roxbury inhabitants were wealthy. Roxbury was one of those special, trendy, old-time artistic places that no one tired of, she explained. Artists, writers, movie stars. There were a lot of them around here, apparently. I wondered what Richard Rainsford did for a living. Had he always had a house here? Or had he and Sarah retired from Manhattan? And what about children? How many children had they had? I peered through the windshield at the wood exterior of the house and counted the number of windows. There were probably two or three bedrooms in there, I supposed, unless the back was bigger than I thought. Children who were perhaps my age. And grandchildren. I craned my neck to see if there were any cars parked in front of the house. I could only make out a closed, detached garage. I glanced at my watch. Just after 2. It had only taken me a couple of hours to drive from the city. Sharla had lent me her Volvo. It was as impeccable as her kitchen. I suddenly wished she could have been with me today, but she hadn't been able to cancel her appointments.
"You'll do fine, sis," she had said, tossing me the car keys. "Keep me posted, okay?"
I sat in the Volvo, anxiety rising with the stifling heat. What the hell was I going to say to Sarah Starzynski? I couldn't even call her that, nor Dufour. She was Mrs. Rainsford now. She had been Mrs. Rainsford for the past 50 years. Getting out of the car, ringing the brass bell I could see just on the right of the front door, seemed impossible. "Yes. Hello, Mrs. Rainsford. You don't know me. My name is Julia Jarmond, but I just wanted to talk to you about the Rue de Saint-Ange. And what happened? And the Tézac family, and..." It sounded lame. Artificial. What was I doing here? Why had I come all this way? I should have written her a letter, waited for her to answer me. Coming here was ridiculous, a ridiculous idea. What had I hoped for anyway? For her to welcome me with open arms, pour me a cup of tea, and murmur, "Of course I forgive the Tézac family." Crazy. Surreal. I had come here for nothing. I should be leaving right now. I was about to back up and go when a voice startled me.
"You looking for someone?"
I swiveled in my damp seat to discover a tanned woman in her mid-30s. She had short black hair and a stocky build. "I'm looking for Mrs. Rainsford, but I'm not sure I've got the right house." The woman smiled.
"You got the right house, but my mom's out, gone shopping. She'll be back in 20 minutes, though. I'm Ornella Harris. I live right next door."
I was looking at Sarah's daughter. Sarah Starzynski's daughter. I tried to keep perfectly calm, managed a polite smile.
"I'm Julia Jarmond." "Nice to meet you," she said. "Can I help in any way?"
I racked my brains for something to say.
"Well, I was just hoping to meet your mother. I should have phoned and all that, but I was passing through Roxbury and I thought I'd drop by and say hi. You're a friend of Mom's?
She said.
Not exactly. I met one of her cousins recently, and he told me she lived here.
Ornella's face lit up.
Oh, you probably met Lorenzo. Was that in Europe?
I tried not to look lost. Who on earth was Lorenzo?
Actually, yes, it was in Paris.
Ornella chuckled.
Yep, he's quite something, Uncle Lorenzo. Mom adores him. He doesn't come to see us much, but he calls a lot.
She cocked her chin toward me.
Hey, you want to come in for some iced tea or something? It's damn hot out here. That way you can wait for Mom. We'll hear her car when she comes in.
I don't want to be any trouble.
My kids are out boating on Lake Lilanola with their dad, so please feel free.
I got out of the car, feeling more and more nervous, and followed Ornella to the patio of a neighboring house in the same style as the Rainsford residence. The lawn was strewn with plastic toys, frisbees, headless Barbie dolls, and Legos. As I sat down in the cool shade, I wondered how often Sarah Starzinski came here to watch her grandchildren play. As she lived next door, she probably came every day. Ornella handed me a large glass of iced tea, which I accepted gratefully. We sipped in silence.
You live around here? She asked finally.
No, I live in France. In Paris. I married a Frenchman.
Paris, wow! She cooed. Beautiful place, eh?
Yeah, but I'm pretty glad to be back home. My sister lives in Manhattan, and my parents in Boston. I've come to spend the summer with them. The phone rang. Ornella went to answer it. She murmured a few quiet words and came back to the patio.
That was Mildred, she said.
Mildred? I asked blankly.
My dad's nurse.
The woman Charla had spoken to yesterday, who had mentioned an old bedridden man. Is your dad any better? I asked tentatively. She shook her head.
No, he's not. The cancer is too advanced. He's not going to make it. He can't even talk anymore. He's unconscious.
I'm very sorry, I mumbled.
Thank God Mom is such a tower of strength. She's the one who's pulling me through this, not the other way around. She's wonderful. So is my husband, Eric. I don't know what I'd do without those two.
I nodded. Then we heard the crunch of car wheels on the gravel.
That's Mom, said Ornella.
I heard a car door slam and the scrunch of footsteps on the pebbles. Then a voice came over the hedge, high-pitched and sweet.
Nella! Nella!
There was a foreign, lilting tone to it.
Coming, Mom!
My heart walloped around in my ribcage. I had to put my hand on my sternum to quiet it. As I followed the swing of Ornella's square hips back across the lawn, I felt faint with excitement and agitation. I was going to meet Sarah Starzinski. I was going to see her with my very eyes. Heaven knows what I was going to say to her. Although she was standing right next to me, I heard Ornella's voice from a long way off.
Mom, this is Julia Jarmond, a friend of Uncle Lorenzo's. She's from Paris, just passing through Roxbury.
The smiling woman coming toward me was wearing a red dress that came down to her ankles. She was in her late 50s. She had the same stocky build as her daughter, round shoulders, plump thighs, and thick, generous arms, black, graying hair caught up in a bun, tanned, leathery skin, and jet black eyes. Black eyes. This was not Sarah Starzinski. That much I knew.
So, you friend of Lorenzo, see? Nice to meet you.
The accent was pure Italian. No doubt about that. Everything about this woman was Italian. I backed away, stuttering profusely.
I am sorry, so very sorry.
Ornella and her mother stared at me. Their smiles hovered and vanished. I think I've got the wrong Mrs. Rainsford.
The wrong Mrs. Rainsford?
Repeated Ornella.
I'm looking for a Sarah Rainsford, I said. I've made a mistake.
Ornella's mother sighed and patted my arm.
Please don't worry. These things happen.
I'll be leaving now, I muttered, my face hot. I'm sorry to have wasted your time. I turned and headed back to the car, trembling with embarrassment and disappointment.
Wait, came Mrs. Rainsford's clear voice. Miss, wait.
I halted. She came up to me, put her plump hand on my shoulder.
Look, you make no mistake, miss.
I frowned. What do you mean?
The French girl, Sarah. She my husband's first wife.
I stared at her. Do you know where she is? I breathed. The plump hand patted me again. The black eyes seemed sad.
Honey, she dead. She died in 1972. So sorry to tell you this.
Her words took ages to sink in. My head was swimming. Maybe it was the heat, the sun pounding down on me.
Nella, get some water.
Mrs. Rainsford took my arm and guided me back to the porch, sat me on a cushioned wooden bench. She gave me some water. I drank, teeth clattering against the rim, handing her the glass when I was through.
So sorry to tell you this news, believe me.
How did she die? I croaked.
A car accident. Richard and her were already living in Roxbury since the early 60s. Sarah's car skidded on black ice, crashed into a tree. The road's very dangerous here in winter, you know. She killed instantly.
I could not speak. I felt utterly devastated.
You upset poor honey now,
she murmured, stroking my cheek with a strong, motherly gesture. I shook my head, mumbled something. I felt drained, washed out, an empty shell. The idea of the long drive back to New York made me want to scream. And after that, what was I going to tell Edouard? Tell Gaspard? How? That she was dead? Just like that? That there was nothing to be done? She was dead. She died at 40 years old. She was gone. Dead. Gone. Sarah was dead. I could never speak to her. I would never be able to tell her sorry. Sorry from Edouard. Tell her how much the Tézac family had cared. I could never tell her that Gaspard and Nicolas Dufour missed her, that they sent their love. It was too late. 30 years too late.
I never met her, you know, Mrs. Rainsford was saying. I only met Richard couple of years later. He a sad man, and the boy.
I raised my head, paying full attention. The boy?
Yes, William. You know William?
Sarah's son?
Yes, Sarah's boy.
My half-brother, said Ornella.
Hope dawned once more. No, I don't know him. Tell me about him.
Poor bambino. He only 12 when his mother died, you see. A heartbroken boy. I raised him like he mine. I give him love of Italy. He married Italian girl from my home village.
She beamed with pride. Does he live in Roxbury? I asked. She smiled, patted my cheek again.
Mamma mia, no. William lives in Italy. He left Roxbury in 1980 when he 20. Married Francesca in 1985. Has 2 lovely girls. Comes back to see his father from time to time and me and Nella, but not very often. He hates it here. Reminds him of his mother's death.
I felt much better all of a sudden. It was less hot, less stuffy. I found I could breathe easier. Mrs. Rainsford, I began.
Please, she said, call me Mara.
Mara, I complied. I need to talk to William. I need to meet him. It's very important. Could you give me his address in Italy? The connection was bad, and I could barely hear Joshua's voice.
You need an advance? He said. In the middle of summer?
Yes,
I shouted, cringing at the disbelief in his voice.
How much?
I told him.
Hey, what's going on, Julia? Has that smooth operator of a husband turned stingy or what?
I sighed impatiently. Can I have it or not, Joshua? It's important.
Of course you can have it, he snapped. This is the first time in years you've ever asked me for money. Hope you're not having any problems.
No problems. I just need to travel, that's all. And I have to do it fast.
Oh,
he said, and I could feel his curiosity swelling.
And where are you going?
I'm taking my daughter to Tuscany. I'll explain another time. My tone was flat and final. He probably felt it was useless trying to glean anything else from me. I could feel his annoyance pulse all the way from Paris. The advance would be in my account later this afternoon, he said curtly. I thanked him and hung up. Then I put my hands under my chin and thought. If I told Bertrand what I was doing, he'd make a scene. He'd make everything complicated, difficult. I couldn't face that. I could tell Edouard. No, it was too early, too soon. I had to talk to William Rainsford first. I had his address now. It would be easy locating him.